Recently, I came across a book by C.S. Lewis entitled A Grief Observed. This is a relatively small book size-wise, just 4 chapters, 93 pages. But it is jam-packed with questions that we probably have not even entertained unless, as Lewis does here, we have had occasion to deeply examine the phases one goes through after the loss of a spouse, a partner, or a beloved mate. There are quite a few factors common to the human condition. Grief is one of them. Most humans have experienced grief to one degree or another fairly early in life. Death of a loved pet, death of a grandparent, a very close friend moving away, etc. And anatomy, in research, is the separating of parts, taking a part of an issue or an object to better understand what it is, how it works, and the effect it can have on those experiencing it. Whenever we hear the word grief in a biblical setting, Job automatically comes to mind. Was there ever a fellow human being who experienced the amount of grief as did our brother Job? In his case, he lost everything except his wife. But he was recompensed many times over in the end. He worked his way through his grief without denouncing God, even though his wife urged him, in Job 2:9, to let go of his dignity, curse God and die. C.S. Lewis wrote this book in an effort to understand what is required for us to navigate this life, which we know will contain the pain and grief of lost loved ones. The loss of his wife was not his first encounter with grief. He lost his mother when he was 9 years old. He lost many friends in World War I, and because he lived in the age of great exploration, he lost many friends to various tropical diseases. Lewis, a middle-class Irish intellectual, was married for a relatively short time to his soulmate, Helen, even though he acknowledged they were direct opposites. She was a divorced Jewish mother of 2, who was his intellectual equal, as well-read and as well-educated as he was. Plus, they were both possessed of total recall. Neither one of them ever forgot anything they had ever read. Her passing at an early age from cancer led to his search for answers to dealing with the near-paralyzing grief that gripped him. What I found fascinating about this book was the sheer number of questions he generated, whether actually on the pages or as a result of his mental meanderings. Lewis possessed an abstract intellect, and his questions often lead down multiple paths. Almost immediately, the book opens. Lewis compares the place where he finds himself like being in deep fear or being unfocused, as if he's drunk or concussed. Sometimes the fog seems to clear a little and he thinks he'll be okay. But then he is right back where he was. And this is where the questions start. I really feel I should issue a disclaimer here. The questions, the reasonings, and some of the conclusions are those of C.S. Lewis. However, I find that they offer something for anyone who has or will experience the loss of a loved one. So let's go with some of the things he wanted answers to. Many may seem rhetorical, but in time of grief, they take on a more urgent importance. Questions such as, Where is God that this should be allowed to happen? Is death a test of faith from God? What are we, merely parts of circles that transect? Is it worthwhile to pray for the departed? Can prayer make any difference once they're gone? Are they still aware of time passing as we are? If they are gone to a better place, why do we want to bring them back? We cannot do over what is past. There is no remake of reality. We can only go forward. And it seems we never get what we ask for. When we say they've passed, what we mean is that everything that was them is gone. That's what's meant by time has passed. It is the past. As we read about heaven in Revelation 21, verse 1, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea." Do you realize what a massive difference that is? More than half the planet is covered with water. Talk of seeing family members again can only be consolations of religion. All talk of reunions are unscriptural. Reality never repeats. Something taken away is never given back. Are we really aware of what we're crying out for? There seems to be little comfort, even though Paul exhorts us not to grieve as those who have no hope. 1 Thessalonians 4:13. There seems to be comfort for those who love God better than they love those who are departed. But in the time of grief, there are none loved better, even better than the living love themselves. Who is the comfort for? Is it for the living? It is. It's for the living. It's not for the dead. Comfort may come in words such as happy, pain-free, at peace. How can anyone know that? Does all anguish end with death? Or do the dead feel the loss and separation as well? If those of us left behind suffer so much, how can it be such a happy and painless event for the departed? If they died in pain, how do we know for sure that all that pain ended with death? It almost seems impossible that perfection comes at the same moment that the breath ceases. Then consider those who say, "I wish I could take the pain for you." That is impossible. But at the same time, there's nothing staked on it. If it suddenly became possible, we'd soon see how seriously we meant it. Is that ever allowed? Only Christ ever could or dared to. Who is the grief for? It's for our own relief. There's nothing we can do for the departed. We wish them back only for our own sake, not for theirs. Do we even question whether bringing them back would be good in their case? What would they benefit from coming back with the same diseases and disabilities? We're trying to restore the past. If we bring them back, they only have to die again. Stephen was the first martyr. He died a horrible death. You can read that in Acts 7, verses 57 to 60. Then consider Lazarus, the brother of Mary and Martha. in John chapter 11. He died. And his sisters had Jesus resurrect him, only to have to die again at a later date. Whose death was better? Stephen, who died horribly once, or Lazarus, who died twice? Remember the old adage, be careful what you wish for. You just may get your wish. People say he or she is in God's hands now. Isn't that where we all are, always? Being in God's hands here in everyday life can sometimes get pretty rough. Why would it change so much immediately we die? Where is the consistency? If God allows us to hurt immeasurably with our loss, can he still allow us to hurt for those who are still living after we die? This leads Lewis to ask some pretty hard questions about our consciousness. How did consciousness come to be? Why are we humans given the ability to see the inconsistency in God, crucified God? We want to take that apart and see what it's, and learn further what it means at any price. If people are no longer, then death reveals a vacuity that was always there. That's nonsense. If there's a vacuity or an empty space, who is it revealed to? And then he questions whether God is good. Evidence during the time of grief suggests the opposite. Does hope just prepare us for the next storm? Is it rational to believe in a bad God? No. Then he concludes, all this trying to figure whether God is either good or bad makes no difference at the time. The only thing we can do with suffering is to suffer through it. We can't change it. Pain is still pain, and it always will be. Grief still feels like pain, only in the waiting. Once you had too little time, but now all you have is time. You and your mate were one ship. Now the starboard engine is gone. One must push on alone. One engine has to make it to the end. Why is it that grief can shake our faith when we've known all along that we were promised suffering? We read in the Beatitudes, Matthew 5, verse 4, blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. We're not given anything that's a total surprise to us, but when it happens, it blurs everything we've known all out of proportion. And then you question your faith. How strong is it if I collapse at the first sign of trouble? We need to determine whether our faith is real or imagined. Why am I so concerned now only about myself and forget all those whom I always professed I was so concerned about? He compares this to trusting a rope. We trust the rope until it matters whether it is able to bear us. Then we find we don't trust it. Or it's comparable to a high-stakes card game. Unless the stakes are so high that loss would knock us senseless, we don't see the value of something. Or it's a house of cards. We build it, it falls down, we rebuild it, and we will keep doing so until something serious like death wakes us up. What constitutes our house of cards? Grief can cause us to question our sanity. We no longer trust ourselves to think rationally or logically. We question the foundation of our beliefs. Are the things I believe only a dream? Or am I only dreaming that I believe them? Grief is not a physical pain. The body can tolerate so much more pain than can the brain. The mind, being evasive, blocks out the grief momentarily. But it keeps coming back and coming back and coming back. Physical pain is continuous. Therefore, it is magnified, a continuous barrage. But grief is like a plane flying overhead, dropping bombs. It keeps repeating and repeating. Grief is not static. Pain often is. Then one day the fog begins to lift. After a good rest, which may not come for many months, the total exhaustion begins to lessen, and suddenly it seems you're able to remember the person better than you have been able to before. The sorrow begins to dissipate, and the barrier with it. It almost feels like you're meeting with the person again. That is also why we sometimes see people who are recently bereaved and they don't seem to be grieving. They may be seeing the departed more clearly in less time than someone else. We do not all grieve at the same pace, nor at the same level. Another thing which seems fairly common is that in order to see something clearly, we need to be somewhat removed from it. Or as Lewis says, you can't clearly see when your eyes are blurry with tears. You cannot recognize the best of something while you're wanting it so desperately. Think of sleep. The more you're overly concerned about getting to sleep, the more likely you'll end up with hours of wakefulness. Or when you're really thirsty, you can't properly savor an exotic drink, no matter how delicious. It is this intense longing that causes us to feel more separated from our deceased. Can it be true that our desperation for help keeps us from receiving what we truly need from God at this time? Are we like the drowning swimmer who can't be helped because of the frantic clutching and grabbing which disables the rescuer? Are we so caught up in our reiterating cries for what we want that we fail to hear the answer when it comes? Scripture tells us to do three things in Matthew 7, verse 7. Ask, and it will be given to you. Seek, and you will find. Knock, and the door will be opened to you. This implies a gentleness, not a kicking and screaming until we beat the door down. In another scripture, John 3:27, and this is referring to Jesus baptizing without first ceremonial washing, a certain Jew came to John the Baptist to find out why he wasn't denouncing Jesus' practice. John the Baptizer answered, "We read that a man can receive only what is given him from heaven." This indicates that we need a capacity to receive. It isn't just showered on us for our loud cries, nor if we ask for something good and then think that only bad things happen to us, even though our future may hold something good. Lewis then goes on to look for reasons as to why the mate is taken away. While the person is present, all our thoughts, actions, and feelings can be directed towards them. But once they're gone, those thoughts, actions, and feelings have nowhere to go. The person who has died represents a whole host of persons, not just one. In Lewis's case, he felt he had lost not only a wife, but a daughter, a mother, a sister, a pupil, a teacher, subject and sovereign, as well as a comrade, a friend, a shipmate, and a fellow soldier. He asks, was the marriage too perfect to last? Did God see the extent of the happiness and decide to take it all away? Or had the relationship reached its proper perfection? Had it become what it had in it to be? So there was no sense to prolong it. Like mastering a particular exercise, once you've learned it, you progress on to the next. We're continually learning, achieving, and then moving on. We call it love cut short. A dance, stopped in mid-step. Or a flower, with its head snapped off prematurely. Again, do the dead also feel the pain of separation? It would seem that all pairs of lovers experience this universal and integral part of the love relationship. Just as marriage follows courtship, autumn follows summer, so separation of death follows marriage. It isn't a truncation of the process, but rather a phase of it. Not the interruption of the dance, just the next figure. One of the things we worry about when a partner passes is that our memories will be colored and therefore no longer true. Once we let go of that fear, we see a clearer, truer picture of our past together. When we stop and take stock after a reasonable time of how we are doing, we must not fall into the belief that the passing was a test of our faith, nor some kind of trial. Lewis compares losing a spouse to losing a limb. No matter that the wound heals, you will never be a two-armed or a biped person again. The damage is irreversible. We may sometimes feel better, nearly normal, but we can never become unbereaved. Some may try and prolong the unhappiness, but is that only vanity? Do we want to be seen as the tragic heroes who slog along, making the best of a bad job? Passionate grief actually seems to separate us further from the bereaved. It's the moments of least sorrow when our memories are the most real. Most people, like Helen, who suffer before they die, ask friends and relatives not to grieve for them when they're gone. Lewis asks then if grieving for them is doing them a disservice. As recent as our grandfather's time, people went to extremes to reverence the dead. They covered mirrors. They stopped clocks. They kept rooms unchanged. They visited the gravesite. They marked each anniversary of the death. And if they spoke about the deceased, it was only in hushed tones. Lewis came to the realization that these things only make the dead more dead. Queen Victoria even went so far as to set out Prince Albert's clothes every evening at dinner time. Lewis felt the less he mourned Helen, the closer he felt to her. As we've heard before, grief repeats and each time brings fresh insight. How often can you say, I've never fully realized my loss until now? This could be years after the death. Looking back, Lewis felt the book had done some good as a safety valve. He had started out to map the state of sorrow. But he discovered sorrow is a process, not a state. Instead of a map, sorrow needs a history. Grief is like a valley, a long, winding valley, where you may discover a whole new landscape around any bend. Even though it is a long valley, sometimes it feels like you're going in circles. And if there are partial recurrences, the sequence does not repeat. Lewis felt he couldn't dwell on the happier times they had before they married, because it seemed as if he were causing her death a second time. So in a sense, her death stripped him of his past as well. Two things Lewis gained from looking back over his grief was, firstly, that the door to God is no longer closed, and that he no longer viewed his time with Helen as a vacuum. His review had centered around himself, around Helen, and then about God. He feels now that his first act of remembrance should have been to thank God for her. Then he wonders if being in God's hands means that Helen is being further tempered. He still had questions about being in God's hands. Does a person ever know for sure where they really are? Physically, if you think you're in a dark dungeon, but you suddenly hear the wind blowing or the waves of the ocean, how can you say for sure that you're not out in the open air? Lewis, with his five senses, an incurably abstract intellect, a haphazardly selective memory, a set of preconceptions and assumptions so numerous that he could never examine more than a minority of them, never became even conscious of them all, wonders how much total reality can such an apparatus let through. He has come to two wildly differing convictions. Either that the eternal vet is even more painful than our severest imaginings can forebode, or that all shall be well. All shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well. He realizes it doesn't matter how many or whether he had any good photos of Helen. The link is what's important. Just like the communion bread, it doesn't have to look exactly like Christ to represent what we need from the symbol. There's a danger in images becoming sacrosanct, just like our idea of God. It's not a divine idea. It's only by shattering it repeatedly that we become truly aware of his presence. The reality of who the earthly person was is what we love after their death. This led him to question how he sees her now, as she was or as she is now, like God. Not our idea of God or of the deceased, but of the actual being. Not the precy of someone we automatically make of those living. We don't really notice a difference between the idea and the reality until they veered pretty far from it. By doing this, we think we know the person. Do we draw closer to God at a death because we think that that road leads to the beloved? God is not a road, but a goal. If we approach him as a means, not as an end, we are not really approaching him, but just trying to reach our beloved. If we only think we'll gain a beautiful reunion with our beloved, we'll be truly disappointed if we try to use God as a means to get there. And then he encounters a paradox. Do we only get to see the beloved because we've come to love God so much that it really doesn't matter whether we ever see our beloved again? There's no answer, except for an impression of a silent gaze which says, "Peace to you, child. You don't understand." Are there questions that God finds unanswerable? Nonsense questions are unanswerable. Like, how many miles are there in an hour? Are colors round or square? Most likely half our questions are nonsensical to God. Then, like Job, Lewis begins to consider his situation. Now that she has died, he has no problem as to whether he has to put her needs first or God. He knows the two great commandments, God first. then reunion with the dead, based on a risky extrapolation of a few experiences here on earth. How much credence does our idea of our relationships carry? If we were reunited with a deceased one, what would the relationship be? Do you see how many of these questions are unanswerable when we think them through? What about the mystical union and resurrection of the body? We can't even formulate an idea, even an image. Our problems will be solved, but not by showing us subtle reconciliations between our contradicting notions. We see there never really was a problem. The real answer is probably found in abject simplicity. Remember, this is from a perspective of a couple who has been split by death. Can the dead see us more clearly now that they're gone? At last he came to a place where he could almost feel a reunion with his beloved. But without the emotion, quite businesslike, but with a sense of intimacy that had not passed through the emotions. No emotion was needed. The intimacy was complete. Without it, only the living need to respond to intimacy with emotion. There's no nonsense about the dead. The adjectives are utterly solid, reliable, and firm. The best is probably what we understand the least. His conclusion? It would be wickedness if we could call the dead back. What can we see after sharing the grief of C.S. Lewis? Sureties. We will lose loved ones to death. We will grieve sorely for those we have loved and lost. Grief is the coping mechanism built into humanity to come to grips with the loss of loved ones. There is healing after we experience the grief process. Death is not a test of faith nor a trial. Death is merely the next phase of life. Death is common to all who are born. We're not singled out to suffer because a loved one has passed. Being thankful for having shared our lives with someone allows us to better understand why we grieve.